Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening. We are so happy that you are joining us once again on an adventure in history. Whether you're listening in your car, on a podcast, on the radio, thank you. We're glad you're here.
Again. We are glad.
Yeah, we are.
Although, don't you think most of our audience are loyal listeners that tune in every week?
Ooh, I don't know. Maybe. You know, my loyal fan, my dad, they actually drove their RV out to the Peter Iredale shipwreck and listened to us while looking out at the ocean last week. I mean, doesn't that sound nice?
But you and me and the ocean?
I mean, goals, what more right?
What more could anybody ask for?
Yeah.
Having us in their head.
And this beautiful visualization. And the, yeah, yes. There you go, folks. There's something to do. You can listen live and watch the ocean.
All right. So a little bit of a hodgepodge show.
Yeah. Those are the fun ones.
They're eclectic.
I do.
It's a little something for everybody.
Well, and this word is perfect, Mac.
Oh, all right.
Perfect.
Perfect. I think perfect means when something is fantastic and, oh, that's not the word. Sorry.
That is the correct way we're going here. So it's a noun. A sailist.
A sailist.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually spelled S-C-I-O-L-I-S-T, but it's pronounced sailist.
I think that is somebody who is a perfectionist when it comes to playing music.
Ooh, this actually is a fitting description of both of us.
Oh.
One who pretends to be knowledgeable on all subjects.
I should be insulted, but I know better to be.
That's why I said both of us. I didn't just call you out.
I like that.
One who pretends to be knowledgeable on all subjects. So we are knowledgeable on quite a few subjects, yes. But every once in a while, you know.
Although I have said repeatedly, the more educated I got, high school to college to graduate degree, I realized how stupid I was.
Right. Yes.
The more I learned, the more I realized how little I really know.
Now that's called critical thinking skills, Mac, and that's a good thing.
Perhaps.
Something we should all strive for. So do not strive to be a sailist. Strive for those critical thinking skills.
Actual critical thinking skills and knowledge.
Yeah, and we're going to help you with some of that tonight.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, so, it might be inane, but yeah. Hey. All right, so I've got two that I identified early that I wanted to quiz you and have you guess what year for the things that happened this day in history around our wonderful globe.
Yep.
So what year do you think Samuel Slocum patents, I love that name too, Samuel Slocum patents the stapler.
Ooh, the stapler.
I know, I would not have been within 50 years on this one.
Okay, so I'm going to go back.
So obviously it's not something obvious.
1899.
Wow, 1841.
Yeah.
See, if I was on Jeopardy and I had to guess because it was Final Jeopardy and I had no choice, I would have been like 1925.
Right. Or even 1960s. Yeah.
1841.
Yeah. And patented. Yeah. That's what's kind of impressive,
He thinks there's a future in the stapler.
Yeah. It's great. So,
and then the other one that was kind of fun to me, Joseph Marion Hernandez becomes the first Hispanic elected to Congress.
Ooh. Okay.
On this date in what year?
On this date. Okay. And this is surprising, too.
Of course it is. Yes.
So I'm going to go 1920.
1822.
Wow.
I know. Wow. Isn't that?
Yes.
So I did the deeper dive on this one.
Okay.
Because I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Why, how, and when? So Joseph Marion Hernandez becomes the first Hispanic elected to Congress on September 30th, 1822. Born a Spanish citizen, Hernandez would die in Cuba, but in between, he became the first Hispanic American to serve at the highest level of any of the three branches of the American federal government. He belonged to a St. Augustine family that came to Florida as indentured servants.
Hmm.
Despite these humble beginnings, records show that his family eventually became wealthy enough to own property and several slaves, and that Hernandez was educated both in Georgia and in Cuba. Throughout the 1810s, the United States made a variety of efforts to take Florida from the Spanish, finally succeeding after Andrew Jackson led an army through the territory in the First Seminole War. What Hernandez did during this time is unclear, but he was either very savvy or very lucky. He fought the Americans during the war and received substantial amounts of land from the Spanish government, but then pledged loyalty to the United States and was allowed to keep his three plantations when the territory changed hands in 1819. It was then that Hernandez changed his name from Jose Mariano to Joseph Marion. The newly acquired Florida Territory was allowed to elect a delegate to Congress, but that delegate did not have voting privileges.
Ooh, okay.
Florida's Legislative Council elected Hernandez to represent the territory. During his brief tenure, he served for less than a year before losing his reelection bid.
Yeah.
Hernandez was instrumental in facilitating the transition from Spanish to American government in Florida. In addition to securing the property rights of many Floridians who remained after the annexation, he also advocated for roads and infrastructure to bind the new territory together and make it an attractive candidate for statehood.
Interesting.
He went on to fight in the Second Seminole War, helping his adopted nation drive the natives from its new territory.
Yeah.
The war saw the loss of two of his plantations, however, as well as the destruction of his political ambitions after he was involved in an incident in which an American contingent captured a number of Seminoles despite approaching them under a flag of truce. Hernandez later served as mayor of St. Augustine before returning to Cuba, where he died in 1857.
And I've been to St. Augustine. It's a beautiful little place right there. It's very on the very northern sort of tip on the east side of the state.
That's what I didn't look up, like where was his plantations, yeah. But I assume somewhere near there.
Yeah, so probably North Florida. But it's so interesting helping, it reads so positive too, while driving out the natives.
Yes, yes.
Building statehood rights for those who took it over.
Yeah, yeah. But I like the infrastructure that he wants roads to connect it.
Yeah.
Because very swampy area.
Yes, it still is. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, that's an interesting one. Okay.
But 1822.
Yeah. Good for him.
All right. So backing up, those are the only two I wanted to quiz you on. 1659, Robinson Crusoe is shipwrecked, according to Daniel Defoe's famous novel.
Oh.
I love that book.
Yes. That's a good one.
As a kid, I loved all of the Swiss Family Robinson, Robinson Crusoe, Mysterious Island, Treasure Island. I didn't like the pirate stuff necessarily, but I did love the shipwreck stuff.
Well, and thus the setting for so many books and movies to come, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think Once Upon a Time I had that, or something similar, as the history highlight, the genre of...
Okay.
It created the genre of...
It's true. Yeah.
Might have been like Treasure Island. 1776, General George Washington complains about his militia.
Ooh.
I kind of like this one, too. In a letter to his nephew, Lund Washington, plantation manager of Mount Vernon, General George Washington writes on September 30th, 1776, of his displeasure with the undisciplined conduct and poor battlefield performance of the American militia. Washington blamed the Patriot reliance on the militia as the chief root of his problems in the devastating loss of Long Island and Manhattan to the British.
Just a
bunch of citizens.
Just lay it out there.
Citizen soldiers. What does he expect? But in his letter, he writes, "I am wearied to death all day with a variety of perplexing circumstances, disturbed at the conduct of the militia, whose behavior and want of discipline has done great injury to the other troops, who never had officers, except in a few instances, worth the bread they eat. In confidence, I tell you that I never was in such an unhappy, divided state since I was born."
Wow. That's something.
That is something.
Harsh words. Poor guy.
And he goes on, he talks about the stupidity among the enlisted men, and he just kind of goes on and on.
Oh, George.
Poor George.
Yep.
All right, let's see. 1787. First U.S. voyage around the world, the Columbia leaves Boston.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think we've done a little bit of a deeper dive on that.
On the Columbia?
Yeah. Then I already talked about Joseph Marion Hernandez. Let's see. 1888, Jack the Ripper murders two more women.
Oof.
Liz Stride and Kate Eddowes in Whitechapel, London.
Mm.
I've never been a big Jack the Ripper fan and all of the... might it have been? I was going to say,
I'm glad.
Well,
got
yes.
it. Okay. The mystery.
The genre and the mystery. Because there's been a million books and and write-ups and documentaries, and I don't know. I'm never interested. Was it the king's nephew, or was it this guy or that guy?
Or just, copycats.
Yeah. I figured you'd like this one. 1889, Wyoming legislators write the first state constitution to grant women the vote. Wyoming.
I love this. 1889. Do you have a little bit more on this?
No.
Okay. They granted this provision, granting women the right to vote. They were formally admitted into the Union the following year, and they became the first state in history to allow its female citizens to vote. Because that was, I was like, okay, they voted on it, but did it actually happen?
Yes.
And it did happen. But they were so isolated, but they were the first to accept women's suffrage, and it was a surprise. So people like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they assumed that their own more progressive home states would be the first to respond. So they used this to kind of shame the people that they were talking to and saying, look what Wyoming's doing.
If Wyoming of all places can do it, why can't New York? Why can't Virginia?
And it was successful. So good for them.
I always like that it is, we've laughed about it, it's the W states like Wisconsin, Wyoming, Washington that are usually the first on things like this. But I also like the fact that it's Wyoming. I think part of it is it's an attractive place for women. Please come here. We'll give you the vote.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that.
It's so isolated, it's so rural, and we want more of you. And I think it's also a little bit of, we are all so independent here that women are just as capable as the guys, so why don't we let them vote?
That's what I was sort of thinking. Yeah. I mean, they have to have sort of dual stakeholdership, right, when you're on a farm and things like that. So
I think it's a little bit of both. So, but good for Wyoming. Yep. 1889. All right, 1895, Stephen Crane's novel, The Red Badge of Courage, is published to wide acclaim. It's a good book. Mm-hmm. This was almost going to be my history highlight. 1946, 22 Nazi leaders, including Hermann Göring, are found guilty of war crimes and sentenced to death or prison at the Nuremberg war trials.
That's good. Yeah.
I've read kind of there's a definitive work on Nuremberg. It's like three volumes, huge. But there's so much that goes into it. And it, what I love about it is that they weren't just, we're the victors, we're going to kill the losers.
Right.
You know, hey, king, you lost this war back in 1700, so we're going to kill you. We want to be thoughtful about this. We want the rule of law. And they documented the heck out of everything. And it just, to me, that was a nice wrap-up for leaders that you are responsible for what your countries do.
Right.
1947, the World Series is broadcast on TV for the first time.
Oh, how fun.
Yankees over the Dodgers. Boo hiss. 1949, the Berlin airlift ends.
Okay.
1954, the USS Nautilus, the world's first nuclear submarine, is commissioned.
Okay.
And I toured the Nautilus.
Did you?
Oh, my gosh. 35 years ago now. I think it's still there, but it was in Groton, Connecticut. I was driving past, and I was like, Nautilus, I can go look at that. It's open. What? And it's pretty cool.
Okay.
Have you ever been to the submarine at OMSI?
I have not.
Oh, you can go through a submarine there too.
But it's tiny, right?
No, I mean, it's like a full-fledged. It was actually in Hunt for Red October.
Oh, that's the, okay. Well, there you go.
Little film history, though it's not Oregon film.
Right. But it's here now.
Still a good movie. So yeah, I highly recommend either going to Connecticut and touring the USS Nautilus if it's still there, or time warping back 35 years and doing it, or go to OMSI and go through that submarine. It's kind of cool. 1955, James Dean dies in a car accident.
Okay.
Jimmy Dean. I like his sausages. 1960, no, it's a different guy.
Yes.
1960, The Flintstones, the first animated sitcom created by Hanna-Barbera, premieres on ABC. Oh my gosh, I thought you might start singing.
Dun, 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 dun.
Do kids today even know, do your kids even know who the Flintstones are?
Not a clue.
That is such a shame to me.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I have a feeling though that if we were to watch it, that, you know, it would be one of those things that would not age well.
Probably not.
Right? I mean.
Well, it's like the Honeymooners, how rude he is. And of course, it's based on the Honeymooners.
The age and time.
Yeah.
So but
as a kid, I still like the Flintstones though.
Yeah.
I loved all the gadgets in dinosaur time.
Well, sure. And the cars and stuff with their feet. Yep.
Yeah. 1991, Jerry Springer's tabloid talk show, Jerry Springer, debuts on TV.
Oh, good journalist. Aside from that,
he was
a very good journalist.
I was thinking about making this a history highlight, but then I thought, okay, he's one of the famous ones, but is he really like the pioneer of this.
Oh, of that? Oh, I don't know. I mean, he certainly was the one that made it the most popular, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because there's Maury Povich, too, is kind of around that same time.
And there's another guy, The Mouth, began with an M, but he was like an East Coast guy, and he was on a local station that then it started, as they all do, kind of, it started into syndication. I can't remember the name off the top of my head now. So that's what made me doubt. Like, maybe he's not the guy.
Yeah. But the popularity of it, right? And just making it sort of easy to watch TV, which, even though it's so terrible.
So I never liked any of those shows.
Really. I know. They're awful.
So 1938, though, my history highlight of the day, the Treaty of Munich is signed. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of England, of Great Britain, comes back and says, peace in our time. And basically, they said to Hitler that you can basically take as much of Czechoslovakia as you want.
Yeah.
And of course there was a moment as Hitler slowly kind of expands the Sudetenland and some others, and he starts rearmament, that he was worried somebody's going to stand up to him. And he's like, we're not quite ready yet. And he would have backed down. I don't know necessarily this one he would have backed down over, because at some point it was just inevitable. But in large part at this point, he knows nobody's going to stop me. I can do whatever I want. We just keep going.
Yeah.
And it's not till, of course, 1939, invading Poland, that finally France and England say, wait, we got to declare war.
Yeah.
But peace in our time, not so much. 1938, it lasted all of a good year.
Ugh, awful.
So my history holiday, what did I miss?
Well, one thing was 1868, the first volume of Little Women is published. Not Little Mermaid.
Not Little Mermaid.
Little Women. So that was important. But yeah, lots happening.
Before we went on the air, you
yes.
said, I'm surprised you didn't mention, or I'm surprised not on your list is Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
And I said, what? How did I miss that? And then we realized you misspoke, and it was Little Women.
Yes.
But I did notice, I just didn't add it to my list.
I forgot Mac was not my child.
Hey, my daughter loved Little Mermaid once upon a time.
Yeah, it was good. And, you know, the remake was good. It terrified my four-year-old, though. Yeah, it was just a little too real for her.
Okay, so since we are in the midst of election time.
Yes.
We thought we would
talk politics the whole time and pick a president.
We would. And then we would each give our picks and our endorsements.
Sure.
No.
Oh, okay.
Not. But, you know, of course, we frequently have some crazy aspects to people that aspire to be the president, and some that become president and have some crazy aspects about them.
Yes.
So we thought we might talk about some of the crazy stuff you might not know about some of our past presidents.
Let's go back in history.
So few professions in the world are as scrutinized and well-documented as the presidency of the United States of America. So it might seem like every single aspect of all the former presidents' lives has already been covered, but sometimes there's just as much interesting material from before they were presidents as there is from their time in the White House. It takes an extraordinary kind of person to run for the highest station in America, so it makes sense that extraordinary origin stories are the norm for Oval Office occupants. Crazy presidential stories don't just come from the White House or the campaign trail. They come from these men's childhood, and at this point, all men.
Yes.
Men's childhoods, first jobs, and even romances. So from wartime adventure to struggles with medical ailments, these future presidents had some unbelievable experiences, and we've just got a handful we figure we'd talk about today.
So let's start with Abraham Lincoln, who was a dueling madman. Abraham Lincoln is America's tallest president, measuring 6'4". He apparently used his size to his advantage before his presidency. Lincoln was a renowned wrestler in his youth, and there's only one known record of him ever being defeated. That fighting attitude went beyond the ring, too. On one occasion, when a political opponent challenged him to a duel, Lincoln accepted on the condition that they fight with broadswords. Fortunately, that fight didn't actually happen.
I love that.
No one to pick him.
Because you know that a guy's not going to agree.
Right, yeah.
Broadswords?
Sure.
What? It just makes me like Lincoln even more. So right now, he's top of my list.
Okay.
Every now and then, he's number two. But he's usually number one. Grover Cleveland hanged people.
Ooh.
Few past occupations look more foreboding on a resume than hangmen. But that's one of the jobs Grover Cleveland did before becoming president of the United States. Cleveland served as the sheriff of Erie County, New York from 1871 to 1874. And one of his duties was executing those assigned the death penalty. Cleveland could have delegated that particular duty, but instead he insisted on doing it himself. First hanging a young Irishman convicted of killing his mother. Oh. Cleveland, his own mother, not
right.
Cleveland's
yes,
mother.
Yes.
That would be different. Cleveland executed one other man during his tenure as sheriff. Some praise Cleveland for his honor, saying that he did the job so no one else had to, while later political opponents tried to use the executions to label him as bloodthirsty. Cleveland was thereafter known as the Hangman of Buffalo.
Okay, there you go. Jimmy Carter saw a UFO. Now, most politicians stay away from the topic of extraterrestrials, but Jimmy Carter claimed to have seen a UFO while serving as governor of Georgia, and it didn't stop him from eventually reaching the White House, although he would forever be known as the UFO president. Carter said he saw a bright, unidentifiable object moving in the sky during October of 1969, and he claimed it was larger than the moon from his perspective. He didn't officially file his report until 4 years later. Carter promised to release any and all secret documents about UFOs when he became president, but alas, he didn't share a single file.
Now, see, does that just make conspiracy people be like, see?
Right. Yeah, or there's nothing.
They wouldn't let him, or does it mean there's nothing
there? Yeah, there's nothing there. But also, like, you can say a lot of things when you want to be president, and just because you say them doesn't mean that you will have the authority to do them.
That's right.
Yes. Sorry, Jimmy Carter. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams vandalized Shakespeare's property.
Tell me more.
Before either of their presidencies, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson struck up a friendship when they both found themselves living in England for a while. The two founding friends toured the country together, taking in all of the history, but that didn't necessarily mean they had a great amount of respect for the past. Adams and Jefferson visited the historic home of Shakespeare, where some of the bard's property was still on display. The two men chipped off a piece of Shakespeare's chair to take home as a souvenir, vandalizing the belongings of one of England's favorite sons.
That's just not right.
It is not right, especially as someone who looks over museums, right?
Yeah, that's yes. Not right. How come it wasn't roped off? How come they were allowed to even get close to it?
Come on, boys.
All right. Andrew Jackson was in over 100 duels.
Wow.
Now, I knew he was duel happy, but 100 of them. Andrew Jackson has a well-earned reputation of being one of America's toughest presidents and other things, I would say, that perhaps we are not allowed to broadcast. His nickname was Old Hickory, and he once beat a would-be armed assassin with his cane. Jackson honed his hot-headed temperament fighting in multiple wars and several small martial engagements, namely over 100 duels. Jackson was a bit duel crazy, challenging anyone who dared call his or his wife's honor into question. He was shot twice in the course of his dueling, and one time he actually killed his opponent.
Can we talk about lessons not learned?
Not learned.
Okay. Gerald Ford appeared on the cover of Cosmo. Good looks aren't an absolute necessity when it comes to running for president, but they certainly don't hurt. Gerald Ford wasn't much of a hunk by the time he reached the Oval Office in 1974, but he spent his youth as the perfect picture of masculinity. He was a football star and even dabbled in modeling, which landed him a gig posing for a magazine cover illustration. That magazine was Cosmopolitan, which is better known today for its hot sex tips and personality quizzes.
I kind of love that because I Ford was not a wonderful president, a great president, but I think he was a good man and tried to do what he thought was best for the country with the whole pardoning Nixon thing. But I never would have thought of him as a hunky male model.
Model.
So I kind of love that about his background. So anyway, Herbert Hoover lived in China during the Boxer Rebellion. Herbert Hoover and his wife Lou moved from California to China shortly after getting married in 1899. Hoover was to consult the Chinese emperor on mining operations. The new job was interrupted when the Boxer Rebellion broke out in 1900 as rebels began a month-long siege of Tientsin, where the Hoovers were living. Hoover helped build barricades while Lou volunteered in a hospital, and some accounts claim that he managed to rescue some Chinese children and keep them safe from the urban warfare. During his presidency, Hoover and Lou would reportedly speak in Chinese while in the White House to keep their conversations secret.
Whoa, I like that.
I like that, too. You know, today, if they did that, they would suddenly be accused of being like Chinese spies or something.
Right. It wouldn't, yeah. It wouldn't go over well.
Just by their knowledge and ability to speak in Chinese and doing it just for like a private conversation.
To keep others out. Right. Yeah. Now here's a fun one. George W. Bush was the head cheerleader in high school. Although he was a decent baseball player, he put most of his high school athletic attention towards cheerleading. In fact, W. was good enough at it that he was the head cheerleader in his senior year at Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. Richard, moving on to the next
one. He's a cheerleader.
Yeah, that's a fun one, though. I like that.
I kind of like that, too.
I mean, it also, like, you got to win the popularity contest, too, when you're running to be president. Right. So Richard Nixon, moving on, funded his first congressional campaign with his poker winnings. In his youth, Nixon was reportedly a fantastic poker player, learning his craft before entering the Navy and excelling at it throughout his time in the service. Nixon reportedly earned enough playing cards that he funded his first congressional campaign in 1946, mostly with poker winnings.
I don't know if that's true, but I want it to be true.
Could be. Could be. Yes. You know, it makes sense he would do that.
Yes.
So here's another one. So George H.W. Bush was shot down during World War II. Have heard about this one. He has a reputation for being of mild character, so those not well-versed in his personal history might be shocked to discover that he was a bomber pilot in World War II. He suffered a crash landing during a bombing run, but his most harrowing experience came a bit later in the war. While serving in the Pacific Theater in September of 1944, Bush and his squadron came under fire from Japanese anti-aircraft guns. Bush took fire but managed to drop his payload and head back towards the ocean before bailing out into the water. He won the Distinguished Flying Cross for his heroics.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures of him like getting fished out of the water.
Oh, wow. And yeah, scary.
Yeah, you're kind of like, wow, just a little bit different and he's not...
Right.
Surviving, and he's not the president, and how does that change everything?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So Theodore Roosevelt formed a volunteer cavalry. Of course he did. While climbing the ranks as a politician, Theodore Roosevelt took a real interest in the Spanish-American War. Rather than sending others to get involved, Roosevelt abandoned his Washington aspirations for the time being and went off to war organizing his own volunteer cavalry, known, of course, as the Rough Riders. Roosevelt himself led the Rough Riders in their legendary charge up San Juan Hill, which they had to accomplish on foot because their horses were still back in Florida.
Oh.
Yeah. When Roosevelt returned to Washington, he did so as a war hero, and that certainly helped his political resume. And I would argue that he knew he was going to come back and run, and he was building his resume.
Oh, well,
I mean, he did believe in the great adventure of a war in his mind.
But to come up with the Roosevelt's Rough Riders, too... we'll end on this one, though. Rutherford B. Hayes struggled with the fear of going insane. He was a controversial president who won the White House in one of history's most hotly contested elections in 1876. Surprisingly, his peculiar childhood was not one of the things used against him in the campaign. Young Hayes struggled with the fear of going insane. He wasn't actually mentally unwell, but why he chose subsequently to aim for the most stressful job in the world? Anybody's guess.
And he's low on that list of good presidents.
Right. It's because he was worried about...
But yeah.
About lots of things.
Now I know why.
Yeah.
Because he was worried. He was going to be insane.
Well, in another 25 years, we can talk about some other presidents.
Yes, we can.
And their antics.
All right. Well, go make some history and make sure when you get your ballot, you vote. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for an adventure in history. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.